Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Fred Garvin Building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, it's Phantasmo After Dark. Our topic tonight, High School Confidential. High School Confidential.
That's right.
Or as I like to call it, Jump Street 58.
the OG Jump Street. By the way, we are Rob Floyd and...
Professor Tony Mercer.
Damn it. See, I was waiting for my weekly promotion.
I don't think you can go much higher than Admiral.
I wanted to be like Viceroy or something.
Viceroy. How about, and we are Rob Floyd and Man at Arms, Tony Mercer.
Man at Arms.
How about that?
Hey, honey, you can be Tila. I wasn't talking to Rob there, by the way. He's not my honey, although not a bad choice.
Well, you know, it's cold nights.
Needs must, as the English say.
So we're trying to Brokeback After Dark. So what was our topic tonight?
OG Jump Street.
Not there's anything wrong with that.
No. So we're actually trying something a little different this time, and that is that we have just finished watching, just now, High School Confidential.
Just now.
We have not done that before.
No.
And the key thing here is that while I have seen High School Confidential many times, this was your first time.
Yes, it was. My first viewing. I enjoyed it immensely.
And we have not discussed it, not even a little, since the movie ended. So now we will be capturing your reaction in real time. Go.
Froze on the spot.
That's capturing something else in real time, and we should save that for Brokeback After Dark.
Well, you know, and another Russ tangent. So, but anyway.
I think Russ Tamblyn is becoming the patron saint of Phantasmo After Dark.
I think he is. But we're not going to review Cabin Boy. So, yeah, we just got through watching the film, and it was a lot of fun. It was everything I expected it and hoped for it to be, and actually a little more.
Yeah.
I wasn't as familiar with it, you know, as you are, and I didn't know how it was going to end or where it was going. It started off as this light Hepcat high school romp, and then it goes into almost like a serious crime picture towards the end.
Yeah.
Which, you saw signs that something was going on, but until it really starts happening, and when the movie takes a turn, you don't know what's coming.
Yeah, we don't really do spoiler protection on this podcast very well, not at all, at least not so far. But I am almost.
Tamblyn was a cop.
Yeah, there you go. I was about to say. I'm almost tempted to leave the to. But listen, if you can't figure out or at least suspect that Tamblyn's a cop within like the first 10 minutes, yeah.
But no, it's cool because it starts out and you think it's going to be just one of those rock and roll, because Jerry Lee Lewis is the first thing you see and you hear.
Yeah.
He's driving in the back of a truck, him and the band playing. So you think it's going to be like any of those other, you know, rock and roll movies and have guest stars of some of the current bands, and the kids are going to be using all the cliched lingo of the time, you know, and even going overboard with it, which they do.
To beautiful effect.
Oh, it's great. It sets the mood and the tone of the movie. I mean, right off the bat. And the lingo is... it's so much that every word they say, almost. You need a program to translate it.
Yeah.
you know? I mean, some of the sentences is just the slang. Every word. And you pay attention, you can pick up on it. But at some of them, you're like... Okay, I think I know what he was talking about. But they start to drop that. As the movie goes on, that starts to get less and less, and the story starts to take over from the mood that it's trying to set.
You know what it reminds me of? You remember that cartoon where the zoot-suited hep cat dies and goes to heaven, and he's standing at the gates and talking to St. Peter, and he's telling St. Peter the story of his life, but he's doing it all in the hep cat lingo.
Yeah,
And what we see in the animation is what St. Peter is visualizing, and it's all as the guy's telling his story, and it's all literal translations of all the slang, right? So the guy's using lots of colorful metaphors. Well, so, you know, we open with Jerry Lee Lewis, I guess, on like the back of a flatbed truck with his band driving down the street by the high school, and all the kids are romping.
For what reason? We have no idea.
The killer was in town, and when the killer's in town, you romp. That's what.
That's right.
Yeah. And then we get to see Russ Tamblyn hop in his convertible and head into school. And during the drive, he pulls out his portable electric razor, you know, the kind that you plugged into the cigarette lighter with the long cord. And he starts to give himself a little touch-up shave on the way in, which is your I guess, supposed to be your first clue, right, that something is not as it seems.
Hmm. Yeah, and then he pulls up and proceeds to be quite a douche to everybody.
It's the least subtle investigation by an undercover narcotics officer in the history of creation. I mean, it's as if he's got a death wish and wants to get caught and killed, you know? It's
overly trying to ingrain himself into the student body and take over as the hippest cat of the bunch. And and what was he say? Be the president of the Wheelers and Dealers. Yeah.
He immediately finds the local leader of the drug dealing clique in the school and starts hitting on his girlfriend and threatening his position. And then he waltzes into the principal's office and asks the young lady working the desk there if she was looking to graze on some grass and all this incredibly unsubtle business.
And I love the sort of subplot where he starts to hit on the teacher and she refuses him, but she slowly starts to become fascinated with him and never says so, but she offers to help him out after school. And
yeah, there's an undercurrent, because you definitely get the impression that in this sort of movie, what you imagine her role to be and what it is largely is that she takes an interest in what she perceives to be a bright, sensitive boy who's in some trouble or whatever. Mm-hmm. But she's clearly flirting back. I mean, he's flirting with her, but she's clearly flirting back with him at several points in the movie. And that's one of the things that makes this so entertaining is this is very much a message picture, right? It's telling you about the dangers of drugs and how it's going to destroy our children and our lives. But there's this undercurrent of lasciviousness that runs through the whole thing. Yeah. It's sort of simultaneously reveling in what it's preaching against, it's an exploitation movie.
Well, and then you've got the whole thing with Mamie Van Doren, who's playing his aunt, who just wants to jump him the entire time. And we don't get a clear what the age difference is there, but regardless of the age difference, it's his friggin' aunt.
We're not clear. So she's, because if you remember the police commissioner later in the film, and it takes a long time for them to actually, you know, officially reveal that Russ Tamblyn's an undercover police officer. So later in the film, when he's talking to the police commissioner, he asks, you know, something about how are things going with Gwen? And then later, Gwen being the Mamie Van Doren character. And then Russ Tamblyn is trying to get a drunk Gwen to cooperate with him on something.
Yeah.
And he says it's important to whatever the police commissioner's name. So, you know, so that implies that she is there in an official capacity. You know, like she's been assigned to him is kind of what that implies.
Yeah.
But it's never really explained. I don't think she's really his aunt, but what is she and why is she there?
Yeah, because
you would think the police wouldn't assign her to him if she's so unreliable that she's basically trying to you know, sleep with him and stays drunk the entire time.
Yeah, because she is. She's like drunk almost the entire time, and then she plants one on him there in the kitchen when she's sober is the first time you see her. And you're like, what the hell is going on? Well,
the real reason why she's there, of course, is to be Mamie Van Doren and, you know, wear a rocket bra and be hot and draw eyes.
And E, all of the above.
Yeah.
She did.
Well, you know, the producer on this was Albert Zugsmith.
The Albert Zugsmith.
That's right. Are you not familiar?
I am not familiar with
Well, he's a low-budget, sort of a notorious figure amongst the low-budget producers of that era. You know, made a lot of exploitation movies of this vintage and of this type.
Oh, okay.
And a few better pictures. Like, I think he produced Incredible Shrinking Man.
Oh, wow.
Which was also directed by the gentleman who directed this movie.
Which we will get into
at some point for sure. But anyway, Van Doren, I think, was a Zugsmith favorite, or at least, you know, he cast her or
she was
employed her
favorite.
Well, and why wouldn't she be?
Mm-hmm.
He employed her in several things. Let's see, Girls Town, I think, is a Zugsmith production that she stars in. Low budget juvenile delinquent movie called Girls Town that I first saw on Mystery Science Theater.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, which here's another tangent right in the middle of the Zugsmith talk.
All right,
so this High School Confidential is very much exactly that. It's a juvenile delinquent exploitation movie from the grand era of juvenile delinquent movies of the 50s and early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
This was a thing then, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You, suburban expansion, bored teenagers with cars and expendable money and rock and roll and
devil's music.
Yeah, all of these things were leading adults to
pay attention to their kids.
Well, at best, to, you know, worry over what their kids are up to, and at worst, flat out fear what's going on with it. And I don't know that that's anything. I mean, I'm sure in generations since then, it hasn't really changed.
Yeah.
And I'm sure in generations before then, there was plenty of, reasons to fret over what these damn kids are up to. These damn Bobby Sex Toxers and their Frank Sinatra obsession or whatever. But again, you know, the particulars of this era that I was sort of checking off before, suburban expansion, rock and roll, and all these things that were going on, probably heightened, or at least as we look back on the pop culture of the time, seem to have heightened that otherwise natural, what are these damn kids up to days, impulses.
Yeah.
And so you had this rash of juvenile delinquent exploitation movies, and I first became familiar with them through Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, well, and even before that. Night Flight back in the day would show stuff like these and like Blackboard Jungle and information film, the PSA information films against drugs and manners.
Yeah.
and driving safety and things
which
like that.
Misty would also do. They did those as well. But for me personally, I became familiar with the genre through Mystery Science Theater movies like the aforementioned Girls Town and The Violent Years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I Accuse My Parents. That's a good one.
Man.
The Beatniks. And several others. I mean, I could sit here and name check them. But the funny thing about that is upon, you know, revisiting Mystery Science after its original run, you know, getting tracking down episodes and sort of revisiting the show, what I found was that oftentimes my favorite episodes, that ones that were the funniest, weren't necessarily the horror ones or the science fiction films, because while those are, you know, often bad and often in an entertaining way, many of them are bad in a way that's sort of predictable, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Whereas when they would touch on other genres, particularly ones that I wasn't familiar with, didn't have as much experience with, they would often produce gold. And my personal favorite genre that they touched on there is these juvenile delinquent movies and just teenage movies in general. Teenage Strangler. That's a fun one. So anyway, ending tangent, getting back to Albert Zugsmith, Girls Town, starring Mimi Van Doren, produced by Albert Zugsmith, as well as A Sex Kittens Go to College.
Oh,
this is a real thing. A movie from the 50s, which is
been
very hard to see for a long time, but recently popped up from Warner Archive. I haven't seen it myself. I'm going to check it out.
I think we need to view that.
We do, in fact. So I'm not sure what the point of all this was when I began, except to say
about the Zugsmith.
That Zugsmith said, just tapped Mamie to say, hey, come be sexy in this movie and make me some money.
And
I guess,
she did.
But what she must have been a last minute write in or something on the script side.
She really doesn't have much to do. She just walks into scenes and walks out, and the scene could have played without her being in it.
Yeah.
You know, she really serves no purpose other than look at these.
Yeah.
And look, we did.
And whatever happened to the rocket bra?
I don't know. It just went out of fashion like things do.
That's a damn shame.
He pokes my eye out with those things. Maybe it was a safety issue because you did poke somebody's eye out with those things. We mentioned some of the conventions of these films where they all had the message, the PSA, the talking right to the camera about the evils of what the movie was about.
Yeah. So the primary concern of this particular juvenile delinquent movie is drugs. And there's a couple of scenes where authority figures are basically making speeches to the audience about the dangers of drugs.
Under the guise of a staff meeting at the high school.
Right. So there's a scene where the police commissioner is addressing the staff of the high school.
It's a very small staff, too. It's only about six teachers.
the dangers of drugs. And to his and Jack Arnold's credit, he doesn't actually turn to the camera and start talking to the audience until the very last couple of lines.
Yeah.
But he certainly does do it. And as you were saying, that's one of the conventions of this genre, is having authority figure types make speeches essentially to the audience about whatever it is that this particular film is trying to exploit.
This could happen to you.
Yes, exactly. Very common thing.
And this has two of those in it, though.
It has two of them. It has the police commissioner lecturing about drugs, and then it has a little exchange with some cops where they're basically talking about how blind parents are to, you know, how parents want to protect their children until the bitter end and resent the cops for trying to point out what's really going on.
Yeah, those cops, that was Sergeant Monologue and Captain Expository,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's just out of nothing, a camera pans over and they just start... They just talk to each other and go on with this message about, well, parents never listen. And when they do, it couldn't, you know, oh, not my child, until it's too late.
Yeah. Well, if you've seen enough of these things, it's hard to argue against High School Confidential being the best of them. You know, this is not, by and large, a genre that saw a lot of high dollar A pictures.
I knew a girl like that one time.
Yeah?
Yeah, but she was by and large. So I mean, this was one of the best of those pictures, is what you're saying?
I'm large. Sorry, inside joke.
Oh god, yes.
Yes, so it's you know, as these things go, you know, it is very much a silly, cheap picture. But relative to many others in its genre, it looks pretty good, moves pretty well, it's consistently entertaining. And one of the testaments to that is how mercifully short and easy to take the authority figures giving speeches scenes are. Because in some other movies, let me tell you, no, sir. Oh, gosh, what's the one? It's either, I think it's I Accuse My Parents. It's either I Accuse My Parents or The Violent Years. I'm getting them mixed up now. Where there's a trial at, you know, the juvenile delinquent is tried.
He goes to trial.
And the judge makes a speech that just goes on and on and on. And it's funny because, you know, the first time I heard that speech, it was as a sample in a ministry song.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there's like big swaths of it. And it's the, if anybody out there is familiar with ministry, it's the one that goes, incapable of appreciating anything that is fine or good or worthy of respect. He became a thrill seeker. Kill for a thrill. Anyway, so that's how that goes. Which, it's a popular genre to sample from in some quarters anyway, because as I think we mentioned the first time this movie came up in one of the previous podcasts, High School Confidential is sampled by Rob Zombie several times in the classic White Zombie album, Los Exorcisto.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe I'll put some trailers. Well, definitely put the trailer from this movie on right before the podcast airs, and maybe throw some others from some of those other movies you were talking about, so everybody can get a taste of the genre as a whole and find out about it. And that would be on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. Check it out and leave a comment and let us know what you think. And, you know, if you want us to shut up or if you want us to talk about more stuff or what you thought of the podcast. And you can also drop us a line at the Phantasmo After Dark email, which is
phantasmopod@gmail.com.
Now, back to the podcast. So, Tony.
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about the cast. How about that? Because
This
actually had a cast of some names, a few names, and a few couple of names of relatives of names.
Yep.
We start off with Russ Tamlin's the star.
Who's quickly becoming sort of the patron of Phantasmo After Dark.
Why, I have no idea, but he is.
The patron saint of Phantasmo After Dark, Russ Tamlin.
Russ Tamlin, which takes us on many Russ tangents.
Yeah.
But you got...
When you're a jet, you're a jet all the way.
That's right. We got Russ Tamlin. We got Mamie Van Doren. We got Uncle Fester.
And did I mention that Mamie Van Doren had a relationship with the producer, Albert
Zucksmith? Well, who wouldn't? I mean, you know, why do you think guys become producers? But Uncle Fester, Jackie Coogan, pre-Adams Family Uncle Fester, I believe. Charlie Chaplin Jr.?
Yeah, in a thankless role.
Yeah, and what was the Barrymore? John Drew Barrymore.
Father of Drew.
There, see? Yeah. There you go. And who else? Was somebody else in that was...
John Drew is...
Oh, Michael Landon.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael Landon, pre-teenage werewolf Michael Landon, I think.
Yeah. Michael Landon, who is playing like the Goody Two-Shoes, captain of the football team type character.
Yeah.
Gets very few lines and isn't meant to be, and yet somehow still manages to come off as a more naturally cool than Russ Tamlin. At Russ Tamlin, the star, who gets, you know, he's in almost every scene of the movie.
Yeah, it's a little forced because, he's trying to ingratiate himself into the bad element kids, and it's just over the top with the lingo and the attitude, but it's fun. I mean, it's fun watching him, but it's like, dude, you're acting like a dick. But I don't think that's about it, really, who's in it that's of name, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of familiar faces, mostly from television, but nothing that I could speak to in any depth.
You know? Yeah, but I think we covered what these folks are known for outside of this.
Well, John Drew, he's a very charismatic cat. Yeah. And he handles the dialogue in the, I will say this, Michael Landon comes off as more charismatic and cool in his three lines that he gets, you know, or four, than Russ Tamblyn manages to. But as far as handling the jive talk, John Drew rules on that.
Even front. With that deep Southern accent, it just seems to roll it really naturally does. Out of him.
Then. He gets he's the one that gets the Columbus speech. If you've seen that clip that we posted on the Facebook page, that's John Drew, who I think is known primarily. Well, you know, he had a troubled life.
He was a Barrymore.
Yeah, unfortunately. But I think he was known primarily for his television work. I think that's
true. Oh, okay. I think he did to look into that.
A few of these low-budget type movies in that era. But I know he was on Gunsmoke and a few other things. Yeah. But
and there you go with the Barrymore.
And there you have with John Drew.
And Mamie Van Doren was known for two things primarily. And Michael Landon, of course, did I Was a Teenage Werewolf and went on to Bonanza. And from there, you know, the things he did in the 80s and all that. But yeah, that's, you know, it had a decent cast as far as name value.
Yeah.
And with the addition of Jerry Lee Lewis at the beginning, just, you know, starting off the picture with a bang, and his name probably selling it more than others, I would think, at the time it came out, as far as star power.
Oh, sure.
You know, but he only's in it for that one song at the beginning, and that's it. You never see him again.
And the song repeats, but you don't see the killer again, not that I can recall.
He showed up for a half a day's work and took off.
I'm not sure if Zug Smith produced it independently and then had it distributed by MGM, or if MGM actually had a hand in the making of it, but it does have the MGM logo at the beginning of it, so that might account for why it has a little bit stronger cast than some of these other ones. Well, a little bit. Anybody you've ever heard of ever in these movies, as opposed to many of the others of a genre of the time. But
but now it also had a strong director.
Right. So, I mean, I talked about it being probably the best example of a genre, and that really ought to be, because it had the characteristically rock-solid direction of one Mr. Jack Arnold.
That's right. Jack Arnold, who had done numerous other things over the years, but in our hearts, most notably, Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
Which, you know, is one of the better... one of the better, if not the best, of the 50s sci-fi horror movies, monster movies. Just the way it's shot, the pacing, and the creature itself, and everything. Jack Arnold was just a rock-solid working director. And what's some of the other things he did besides the creature?
Well, so, I mean, remember that he did that a string of really strong science fiction movies, because he directed It Came From Outer Space.
Oh, yeah.
And Tarantula.
Yeah.
And one of my personal favorites, The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go. That's the one I was trying to think of, which is a fantastic picture. It's definitely stands out from the pack of the most of the stuff that was released at that time.
Yeah.
More of a thinking man's sci-fi movie.
Well, he was a workhorse. Did a lot of different kinds of movies, worked in genre, usually. I mean, he did some westerns, and he did these sci-fi pictures, and, you know, some crime pictures and various other things. And I think... after the 50s, he moved into television.
I was going to say, didn't he do some television? Yeah.
Yeah, I think he pretty much, you know, lived out the rest of his career in television after that. But, you know, he's not somebody that you see a lot of books written on.
Yeah.
So I've done a little bit of reading on him, but I haven't really found a whole lot to read. But I do recall that he had a genuine interest in science fiction. It was something that enjoyed growing up and
shows in his work.
I would say... I wouldn't call him a great, you know, visual stylist or auteur necessarily, but definitely a rock solid workhorse. And all of his science fiction films, even something like Tarantula, which could easily have been just as poor as a great many of those giant insect movies tend to be, are good. I mean, they're always very strong examples of their given genres and within them. mm-hmm. if not in something in High School Confidential, but within them, there's always little moments, little touches.
Yeah.
That really stand out. You know, I think one of the more talked about moments from Creature, for example, is where one of the characters, I believe it's Julie Adams, tosses their cigarette into the lagoon.
Yeah.
And then we follow the lagoon down, or we follow the cigarette down through the water as the creature watches it fall. You know, just little moments like that, I think, are what I think about when I go mining for you know, stylistic gold from Arnold. But for the most part, what you're talking about is someone who takes material like science fiction films, which were being cranked out very quickly, mm-hmm. and oftentimes, not always, of course, but oftentimes without much care, or something like a High School Confidential, and sees to it that it works, and you know that it flows and moves and functions narratively. And, mm-hmm. And it's entertaining and solid.
Yeah. So almost makes it a step above a B picture.
Yeah.
Not quite an A picture by any stretch of the imagination, some of the stuff, but definitely not the typical B fare that was out.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things. It's like when we talk about comics and I say, if you really want to appreciate what Stan Lee was doing in the 60s, you need to mm-hmm. read other comics from the 60s.
Yeah.
And then you'll get it. Right.
Yeah.
If you come into that stuff cold, you might wonder, maybe it'll resonate with you, but there's a good chance you'll mm-hmm. wonder what all the fuss is about. But then, okay, read some of other people's comics from around the same time, and you know, spend a good amount of time with that, and then come back to this, and then you'll see why it's a breath of fresh air and it stands out. Same deal. You know, don't misunderstand us. High School Confidential is a low budget, rather
it's not high art,
silly little picture. But if you watch several others from it genre and then come back to it, you'll go, oh
yeah,
okay, now I see what you're saying.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, this moves along at a good clip. Yeah. And it's engaging. All right, well, okay, if you're gonna, like you were just saying, watch some of the other ones, what's some of the ones you would suggest to watch?
The fact that Mystery Science Theater covered several of these is to your advantage if you're interested in seeking them out. Not only because it helps to make some of the more obscure ones easier to find.
Yeah.
Because if it's a Mystery Science Theater episode, you might be able to buy it on DVD, or frankly, you can probably just find it on YouTube.
Yeah. YouTube, Netflix, Hulu, I think might even have some on it.
It's also to your advantage because the Mystery Science Theater cast can help you through the movie and some of the some of the areas where the film itself might be a little less compelling than you might like for it to keep your attention.
Less compelling.
So I would definitely say check out some of the ones that were covered by Mystery Science Theater. Start there. And for specifics, Violent Years.
Yeah.
Violent Years is a fun one, and it's definitely one of my favorite Mystery Science Theater episodes generally. And you can't miss with Miss Van Doren, so let's go for Girlstown.
And there you go. Even some of those kind of along the I guess you classify it in the same genre, sort of, but those educational films from the 50s that I was talking about, you saw on Night Flight, it's the same vibe as these, and it's the same thing, except these were actually serious. They weren't a story. They're giving you some information, a serious public service announcement. I think Something Weird Video might have a couple discs of those, or at least in some of the extras on some of the films.
I think, since you mentioned it, Something Weird actually released Violent Years, if you'd rather see it without the commentary. Yeah,
and I bet the extras on that disc are incredible.
It comes with a second. I was about to say, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Now, let me stop right there and say this. I do the editing on the podcast.
And God bless you for that.
And so I have to hear us a lot as I'm going through.
And God bless you for that, too.
And I'm just waiting for someone to go to come up with the Phantasmo After Dark drinking game. And if you have to drink every time I say, if I remember correctly, you'll get drunk pretty quick. So if I remember correctly, what on earth was I talking about before that?
The Something Weird double disc of Violent Years and...
Yes. If I remember correctly, there's actually another feature. That the extra is another movie. It's Teenage Gang Debs, I think it's what it's called.
Ooh.
Yeah. See, yes, I could reach over to my iPad and look that up on the internet, but we like to keep things real here on Phantasmo After Dark.
Real and fresh, yo.
Anyhow, so Girls Town in Violent Years, either through Mystery Science Theater or Something Weird Video, help yourself to that. As far as one that's painful.
Yeah, hit us. Go ahead.
I Accuse My Parents, another Mystery Science staple. Yeah, check that out.
And is anybody in that one, or is that just a bunch of unknowns?
No, nobody's in that one. Yeah. I think I was about to say it again. You're drunk now.
If Tony remembers correctly.
Nobody in Violent Years, nobody in I Accuse My Parents, Mimi Van Doren in Girls Town, along with Paul Anka.
Ooh.
Yeah, how about that? And Mel Torme.
Oh.
Mel Torme's
well,
in Girls Town.
That's worth watching right there.
Yeah. Skip bop doodly bop bop doodly bop bop.
That's right. Mel Torme, worth any man's money. Right there. Now, didn't he do another like a science fiction picture? Like Giant Gila Monster or something like that. Wasn't he one of those?
I don't recall.
Yeah, that'd be another.
I do not recall correctly.
That'll be another podcast, the Mel Torme Hour. So you said before this is one of your favorite genres. Do you have any idea why that might be? What the appeal is to you? Did you always just want to be a hep cat? Or
That's it. I always wanted to be a hep cat. The jive, you know, the hip lingo.
Yeah,
that's always fun.
Yeah,
and you'll get it to varying degrees in these movies, but really, I don't. Okay, so here's a slice of philosophy for you. I don't believe in the guilty pleasure.
All right.
I don't ever feel guilt about what I like. You know,
I'm with you on that.
Ever,
I'm with you on that. Know? Yeah,
and I sometimes get a little annoyed with the phrase "so bad it's good."
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those things that gets overused.
Yeah.
And I also, it's not going to be a long tangent, but I'm on a tangent here.
Go for it.
The word camp has a meaning that is not what most people seem to think it means. Camp does not mean low budget and it comes off to you as silly. Camp is a conscious thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to make camp, you choose to make camp. Camp by definition is self-aware.
Okay, yeah.
Camp is not a synonym for cheesy.
I.e. the Adam West Batman show.
Right.
The perfect example.
That is camp. It's self-aware. That is what camp is. Look it up, damn it. It doesn't mean low budget, okay? All that said, these movies are just so ridiculous. They really are.
And charming.
What little you'll ever read about them, people like to call them camp. They're not, because they're not self-aware enough to be.
Yeah.
But at least they don't come off that way. But man, they ride the line, because what you're getting is middle-aged men writing about youth culture and trying to capture the hip lingo and 26 to 30-year-olds playing teenagers and these things. You look at them and you're thinking they had to be kidding, you know.
Yeah.
From the nature of teenage, from the very idea of feeling threatened or afraid by our nation's children, our nation's teenagers, to, again, you know, middle-aged men trying to write how teenagers think. And the whole thing is just so ridiculous. It's totally over the top, to the extent that I could forgive anyone for labeling it as camp incorrectly, because, again, it's hard to imagine they weren't trying to do that. Yeah. And it's consistent. All of them are like that. And in a way, I mean, you can almost take them like horror movies, but what's supposed to be scary are your kids, you know? And I don't mean that in a Damien, you know, bad seed kind of way. I just mean them and their damn rock and roll and their drugs, you know, which is for example, talking about the teenage hysteria, there's the term I've been struggling for as I articulate poorly during this podcast so far is, teenage hysteria, the hysteria around youth culture in the 50s. There you go.
Ta-da!
And I lost my point. What was I found my phrase and lost my point.
Teenage hysteria in the 50s, where there was horror movies, monsters.
Drugs.
Are bad.
Drugs fuel the teenage hysteria, but it would help a lot if the folks writing these movies had the faintest idea about drugs, because apparently marijuana is every bit as addictive and
people have the DTs for marijuana, the withdrawals and the cold sweats.
High School Confidential teaches us that kids will jones for reefers and turn to petty crime and, you know,
become weed heads
to get a stick.
She started out with marijuana, now she's hooked on heroin.
That's what happens.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a, the other, I get maybe it's a subgenre or a sister genre of this, was where the music, the rock and roll music is bad as drugs.
Yeah.
And that's how this one kind of starts off. That's what I thought we were getting into. It was more of that. But it turns into, like I said, a drug picture, an anti-drug picture. But, you know, in a touching back, you said that you don't believe in the word in guilty pleasures, which is, I think, has just become like a slang term for anything that's not an A picture that people like. But I understand where you're coming from, because I'm the same way. I mean, I like what I like, and regardless, I know some movies are bad and some movies are good, but I don't feel guilty for watching the ones that aren't Academy Award winners, you know, or B pictures are really super cheesy, because that's the attraction to a lot of those.
Yeah, my point is not if I like it, it's good. My point is if I like it, good or bad, I don't feel guilty about that, you know.
Yeah, and there's also, now I tell you, a friend of the program, John Dimes, wrote a book called, I believe it's called There Are No Bad Movies, Just Bad Audiences, where I still need to get the book and read it. Sorry, John. But his pretty much philosophy of that, a statement is, the movie is what it is, and you're either a good audience for it or you're a bad audience for it. And if you liked it, no matter where the movie falls in the cheese factor, you're a good audience for the movie. And if you didn't like it, well, it just wasn't meant for you, and you were about it, bad audience for it. Instead of calling the movie out for what it is, it's just your opinion of it that goes one way or the other, you know.
Which I like that.
Kind of a neat take on it.
Yeah, and that's good.
And I am going to order the book at some time, John. I really do want to read it. So,
well, you know, the idea of the guilty pleasure sort of speaks to a cultural standard for quality that doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
Because it's all entirely, I mean, if a cultural standard for quality existed, then everybody who likes those Michael Bay Transformers movies would understand that they were or ought to be guilty pleasures if one is to feel guilty for enjoying something below the cultural standard. Right. But,
yeah.
But there, you know, there seems to be this idea, vague though it may be, that there's some, you know, sort of threshold for quality, and below it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to acknowledge that this isn't as good as whatever is above it, and, you know, feel guilty about it. Everybody does it, including me to some extent. We do it right here on this podcast when we talk about, well, it isn't high art. And again, I listen to us a lot because I do the editing.
Yeah,
so
yeah. I've
heard that phrase a lot.
I use that term a lot. And I think mainly just for the people who, well, anybody that's listening, just to give them a baseline of what we're talking about.
No, I get it. And it's not a criticism.
Yeah.
I'm just pointing out how, what is, define that, define art, you know, what,
well,
is,
yeah,
that's a whole other podcast,
and that's a week's worth of podcast. Define art. I like Xanadu, god damn it.
Yeah, there you go.
How about that? And not ashamed to admit it, I love Xanadu. There, I said it.
You
it's
did.
Out there. I feel no shame.
You should.
And Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the movie, I love that too. So anyway, back to High School Confidential.
I'm stunned. No, I'm not stunned, because I knew that already.
You knew that, yeah.
I'm looking for something like pithy to say about Sgt. Pepper's, but
you can't.
The red haze of pain before my eyes prevents me from being
clever. You weren't a good audience for it? Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
No, I was not a good audience for the Sgt. Pepper's movie.
But yeah, the guilty pleasure, fact or fiction. I think that's the tangent we're on now. But how about we go back to the film?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's do that. This being one of the better of the genre, or the best of the genre.
Best of the ones that I've seen, anyway.
How much of it do you think is the director? How much of it do you think is the story? The stories are pretty similar in a lot of them, except for maybe the Jump Street angle with the undercover cop, right?
Yeah.
Drugs are bad. Kids are bad on drugs, and the parents are worried about them and got to get them off that stuff.
Well, it depends on how good of a job the particular picture does at exploiting its theme, right? Because sometimes, for example, the Beatniks, the kids get up to a lot of bad things. You know, the 30-year-old kids get up to a lot of bad things, but the beatnik element of it doesn't play all that much. You know, there's a little bit of it here and a little bit of it there, but not even the movie's trying to tell you that Jack Kerouac drove these kids to, you know, knifing the convenience store owner or whatever the hell they get up to in that movie. But
a little sidebar here that I forgot, that one thing I love about this movie, where they give you an out, or reason rather, why Russ Hamlin might look older than the other students, being a cop. When they look at his record, they say, You've been in high school 7 years.
Yep, yep. Two is a junior and three is a senior.
I think, don't they like throw you out if you've senior twice or something? They don't give you a third try these days? And he was a troublemaker in his last school.
And he's grazing for grass. He wants to be the president of the Wheelers and Dealers.
Yeah. Wants to score some H. Some goofballs.
He's all hopped up on goofballs.
Well, you know, they all were back then.
Mm-hmm.
I love that Uncle Fester is the heavy in this. Is the Mr. A, the Mr. Big of the drug underworld in this town.
Yeah.
He is the boss grass in this town.
And he's a right bastard.
Yeah.
There's a...
He's straight up just, this is my business, and you get in my way, you're going under.
There's a young lady who's in the movie who's a character. The function of her character is to illustrate... That's my dog barking. The function of her character is to show us how smoking pot will definitely lead you to heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she ends up hooked on the smack. And it turns out that Mr. A is withdrawing horribly, but yeah. Mr. A is withholding her heroin because he's trying to get her to agree to go and join some girlfriends of his up in a little house upstate.
Which alludes to prostitution.
Right.
It doesn't come right out and say it, but it alludes to, you know, okay, this is the next step in the evolution of your drug dependency is you're going to go into prostitution. And... It gets a little dark right there.
Yeah.
But it comes, they pull right back out of it, but it's kind of giving you that it's as worse than you think.
Yeah.
You know, watch it, kids. This could be you. Which is, I wasn't expecting it to go there.
Yeah.
You know, and it was kind of cool. Nice surprise for, you know, this lighthearted romp to start going down this kind of path, but they don't rub it in your face and they come right back out of it and you get back into some.
Well, I don't think it was meant to be a lighthearted romp. I think it just plays that way.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, at the beginning, though, the way it starts off with the high school and the cars and the rock and Jerry Lee Lewis and the hip lingo.
Let me take that back because
okay.
I think now it is very much, I think, meant for you to have fun with the same things that it's trying to present. Again, the rock and roll music and Jerry Lee Lewis showing up and maybe Van Doren being there and some of the other little touches of lasciviousness that I mentioned earlier and whatnot. Yeah. So, well, it's meant to be.
Yeah.
It's entertainment.
It is entertaining and they don't rub your nose in the message part. I like how it kind of evolves. Yeah. As the movie goes on into that, where, like I said, you're watching this hip rock and roll and the new kid in school, and he's trying to hit on the teacher, and he's, you know, and his friends, and everybody's talking the hip cat language, and then it slowly, you find out there's a drug problem in the school. Then you find out who's supposed to be his aunt has having these incestuous feelings towards him and plants a kiss on him in the kitchen. It starts to get in some dark areas without getting too dark. But it moves at such a pace that you're like, wait, that was his aunt that just, what? Wait. It doesn't dwell on it, and there's not any music cues for the ominous, you know, stuff like that. And then when the teacher starts flirting back with him, which is, oh, come on, you know, I mean, that's wrong. You know, women are going to jail these days for having sex with male students, you know. And then it gets into the Mr. Big, the Mr. A, and the drug stuff, and it could have gone, if they made it today, it'd be a completely different picture. It would be dark and gritty once it gets to that point. And I like the way this approached it all. It gets you a touch of how it could be, you know, there's messed up stuff going on here, but it brings back out into like, okay, let's keep this, you know, this is a fun movie, let's keep it going, you know, but it keeps your attention, and later on it makes you go, no, wait a minute, there was an incestuous aunt. He's an undercover cop in high school. There's a drug problem with marijuana and heroin. Kids are hooked on heroin in high school.
Where's my checklist?
In this town. You've got the teacher who has impure thoughts about one of her students. And you've got the Mr. Big of the underworld who, you know...
Is Uncle Fester.
Is Uncle Fester. And he has this girl in the room in his office is having withdrawals who... He'll give her a hit if she goes up to the, you know, and joins the whorehouse.
High school girl.
Up, you know, out of state. And then we got, at the end, we got a nice little brawl, a little fight scene in the club there.
Yeah.
Where you see Russ Tamlin do some judo throws and...
Oh, well, that's one of the what the frick moments in the movie is where Mr. A's henchman has the drop on Russ Tamlin. It's got the gun on him.
Yeah.
Actually, no, Mr. A has
That's
the gun.
That's Mr. A, yeah. Yeah.
So Jackie Coogan has the gun on mm-hmm. Russ Tamlin. And suddenly there's a loud noise. I guess the band starts playing, and Russ takes that opportunity to throw what flower in the face of...
Was it I thought it was the bag of heroin he ripped out.
Oh, you're right.
He had the bag of heroin in his hand.
Right.
So Coogan got a face full of H.
Got a face full of H.
Mr. A got a face full of H.
And then Tamlin's character seems to make the choice to use the teenagers in the club as a shield as he's getting chased by the heavies, right?
What the one waiter in the club, Charlie Chaplin Jr., is a cop, we find out. He's working with Tamlin,
yeah.
Right? And then he goes, Michael Ennis is, whatever, so-and-so told me that I could count on you if we need you. And he's like, yeah, and he just says, I'm a cop. He shows him his badge, and upstanding Michael Ennis goes, sure, we're in. So he and his football guys or whatever start brawling with Mr. Yeah. A's henchmen.
Let me enlist the help of these teenagers to take on Mr. A.
I love the one guy. I don't know what he does, but he wraps something up in a tablecloth and swings it around like a sling and throws it and breaks the chair that Mr. A's holding in front of him. It's like, man, that kid was serious.
Yeah. Well, old Russ doesn't really use the other teenagers as human shields, but what he does do is run out into the middle of the crowd at club
and jump over a table in the middle of this whole club full of people.
Flip over a table and get behind it for cover, you know, while the teenagers are trying to run away and just barely getting out of the line of fire, right?
And Fester starts a shooting.
I don't think that's how they teach you to do it in cop school.
No.
At the police academy, pardon me.
They wouldn't have done that on Jump Street.
They would never. Lessard wouldn't have taught them that at the police academy.
Mahoney never would have done that.
Gutenberg and Winslow would never have stood for such a thing.
No. None of those shenanigans. But, you know, like I said, my first watching of this film, and it was entertaining. I was engaged the whole time. It was a lot of fun. There's a lot of... I mean, I can see how MST3K, you know, had a ball with this. It's a lot of stuff that's easy to rip on, but in a good-natured way. I mean, the movie is fun the whole time you're watching it. It never even those moments I said where it kind of starts to hint at a dark area, a dark path, it never brings you down. You know, you never feel like, ooh, things are getting serious. You're like, wait a minute, are they talking about it?
did that just happen?
Yeah, and then it goes right back into some hep cat, you know, I dig what you're saying, you know, I'm throwing it down, you're picking it up. It's like, huh? Okay, I think I know what they mean. Let's go. I enjoyed the hell out of it. It was a lot of fun. I wish I had some popcorn while we were watching it.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I'm looking forward to checking out a couple others, and maybe we can do another one on this.
Right on. Well, you know what we ought to do? I think... this may end up being like a bonus episode of Phantasmo After Dark when I get done cutting out all the stuff where I'm just sitting there trying to figure out what I'm trying to say. It'll be like 20 minutes long and it'll be a bonus episode.
We can keep going. There's more. And you can cut this part out where I said we can keep going too.
But if we ever try this again, this view and record approach mm-hmm. to something you haven't seen or one of us hasn't seen before, you know what we should do is some Russ Meyer flicks.
I was thinking that. I was thinking that driving over here actually today. Yeah. To the Phantasmo Lounge and took the elevator up to the penthouse suite. I was thinking that Russ Meyer would be a really good one to talk about because the name is familiar to a lot of people, and Faster Pussycat Kill Kill and Terra Satana and all that stuff. There's a lot of gold in there to talk about. And what's some of his other films?
Oh, gosh. So you've got Lorna.
Yeah.
And Mud Honey.
Mm-hmm.
And Faster Pussycat, which you already mentioned.
Yeah.
Vixen, Super Vixens.
Oh, yeah.
Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens.
Yeah, yeah.
lots of good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely have to do that one, too. Check upcoming podcasts for Russ Meyer and many, many others. Mm-hmm. That's good. That'll be some good stuff.
Yeah.
Right now, we're talking about High School Confidential.
Well, we were talking about High School Confidential. We've been talking about it for an hour, and I'm out of shit to say.
We could cut it there. Maybe.
Oh, did you something else you wanted to say?
Well, I was just saying the high school. Well, I was just talking about the genre, the high school genre, and the teenage movie genre. Which is the genre and which is the subgenre of that? Because you have, I guess, the teenage film genre is the whole thing. Because then mm-hmm. you have the subgenre of the juvenile delinquent films, which I guess that's High School Confidential is part of that. And then you got the I Was a Teenage Monster films, and then the rock and roll music teenage films. They all kind of tie together, sort of. I mean, it's all aimed specifically at the teenage drive-in goer to pull them in to see the movies. And these are definitely not movies that adults were interested in back then. Not as such.
Well, that's very interesting, because that's something, as it relates to the juvenile delinquent movies, I've never really thought about before.
Yeah.
Who was the intended audience for these movies?
Yeah.
You watch them and you get the impression, you know, because you've got folks making speeches about what parents need to look out for, or school faculty needs to look out for amidst the kids and whatnot. And you can easily take away from that the impression that these movies were intended for adults, you know, as a window into what your kids are up to and all the things that you should be worried about. They're kind of presented that way.
Yeah.
But again, we've talked about how something like High School Confidential entertains with the very things to some extent that it's you know, supposed to be showing as negatives. And does the adult audience, who would in theory be receptive to these preachy speeches, are they really going to sit through Jerry Lee Lewis and, you know, whatnot, and Bobby Soxers and all these things and enjoy it? I mean, could they really have been the audience for it?
And that the audience back then, because you figure the mom and pops who had teenagers back then aren't like mothers and fathers today.
Well, the teenagers at that time are all war babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Joe, World War II vet. Is this guy, you know, in 1958, is this...
with his Brill Cream hairdo and his right. crew cut sides. And
is he the guy that's going to sit through something like High School Confidential or The Violent Years? And I think the answer to that absolutely has to be no. And assuming the producers knew that, and they had to have, then really, I guess what you're dealing with here, and this, I'd never really thought about this before, is...
Good thing I showed up.
How do you, in the 50s... show teenagers, a teenage audience, movies about that kind of thing, that sort of subject matter, about drugs and about sex and about teenage crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And get away with it.
And have them pay attention. Hold their interest.
And get away with it. Okay, so if you make a movie about teenage criminals or teenage drug dealers or pregnant teens or whatever it is that you're, whatever subject you're exploiting, and you release it straight, you know, as here's a teenage crime wave movie, which is another one of these movies, by the way, teenage crime wave, but here's a teenage crime wave movie that just is about what it's about and not framed in any other way, presented to the teenage drive-in audience, there'd have been a backlash for that. You know, parents and whatnot would have flipped, or at least at that time, filmmaker or producers probably assumed that the parents would flip. So how do you get away with it? You frame it as a public service message.
Yeah.
And you put in speeches about how you parents out there need to be watching your kids to make sure they don't do this. That's how you get away with marketing teenage crime wave movies to teenagers. And it's bloody obvious. Well, and why I never thought about it before is embarrassing. But that's what these are.
Yeah. Well, and I think you hit it on the head. Is what that does is framing it as a public service message, but not... I'd have to see how the marketing was done back then for these movies, but that sells it to the parents that it's okay to let their kids go to this movie, because the parents are thinking, well, this is going to teach them something. But the rock and roll and the Jerry Lee Lewis at the beginning and the hip cat talk and is to make the kids want to come see it,
right,
to draw them in.
Well, those things are the real point. And the rest of it's just a game, you know, to get away with the kind of content they were, you know, selling, essentially.
Yeah. How's that? Did you like that?
That's the thing, right?
Right on.
That's it.
But overall, two thumbs up for me. It was a lot of fun, and it went in a direction that I didn't expect it to go in, and I enjoyed that part of it, too. So, yeah, I'd watch it again.
Say goodnight, Daddy-O.
Good night, Daddy-O. Hey, before we say goodnight, though, let's one more time Let's give out the address for the email in case anybody wants to drop us a line, let us know that they were listening, and give us words of encouragement, or tell us just to hang it up. What is that email?
Phantasmopod@gmail.com. That's phantasmopod@gmail.com.
And also on Facebook, there's Phantasmo After Dark, the Facebook page. You can leave comments there. You can check out trailers from these films we talk about and pictures from the movies and any interesting things we can think of other to put on there, if that is even correct grammar. But anyway, now, good night, Daddy-O.